Hello and welcome to this edition of Viewpoints on this week's show. Grief in Three Dimensions, Canadian composer and playwright Britta Johnson talks about Life After, the musical that grew up with her.
There's music in the show that I wrote when I was 16. There's music in the show that I wrote like truly this week. I'm collaborating with my younger self, I think, is where like the truth of the story lives. I think people seem to respond to this story as if it's telling them the truth, and I think it's because it comes from that very honest place. So as like my craftsmanship has grown as I've grown up.
Syrup for Soldiers, a father and son duo, turned their maple sweet success into a Haliburton County charity.
As I was thinking about all of the carnage that our fellow countrymen suffered while serving our country, and very graphic things, you know, like eyes gone or legs blowing off, and I thought, oh my goodness, this is like, what can I do?
And we'll travel next door, well, some 250 kilometers away, and full steam ahead to the Elliott Tree Farm to get a taste of its version of the maple gold.
We're here to promote Ontario maple syrup. All of the farms that you see with the buckets hanging out around here, it's a tradition, it's a sign of spring. It's the first harvest of the year in Canada. You know, it's something we can all be proud of.
Welcome to Viewpoints, local news nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Hello to you all. Nice to have you with us. My name is Boris Chassay, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Today, it's an all-Ontario cast. First up, and as promised last week, we're all set for a chat with Canadian composer and playwright Britta Johnson. In this story, Johnson talks about her musical, Life After. It's now playing at Toronto's Ed Mirvish Theatre, and it's the show's biggest stage since its debut 9 years ago at the Toronto Fringe Festival. In this six-time Dora Award-winning musical, Life After tells the story of a 16-year-old girl who is grappling with the loss of her father. Britta Johnson began the writing process for Life After when she was only 16. During this process, Johnson connected with her younger self in an altered state of grief, but also with the cast members along the way who told their stories. They found community in shared loss. Britta Johnson joins journalist Mia Johnson, no relation, to talk about how Life After matured as the playwright grew up and how she's managed to capture and keep that initial intimacy she had at 16.
A Canadian musical has caught the attention and the hearts of some of the most acclaimed audiences and critics alike.
But suddenly I'm out of words. I'm out of words. I'm out of words. I'm out of words. This says.
Britta Johnson's Life After takes on its biggest stage yet. The production is spearheaded by Yonge Street Theatricals. It's a Tony and Olivier award-winning production company. Now, the show itself follows a 16-year-old who is coping with the loss of her father. After taking home 6 Dora Awards, this will be the first time the show returns to Toronto in 8 years. It's been a massive success, not only in Canada, but also in the United States, making waves at San Diego's Old Globe Theatre in 2019, and then at Chicago's Goodman Theatre in 2022. But to go back to the show's roots, it first got its footing at the Toronto Fringe Festival 9 years ago. Britta Johnson is a Stratford-raised composer and award-winning Canadian playwright. She is the talent behind Life After's book, lyrics, and score. The main character, Alice, is 16 years old, the age Johnson was when she wrote the show's first song, Poetry. Britta Johnson stopped into the studio to tell us about the show's rich journey and how it's matured with her as she's gotten older, but how she still managed to preserve its raw spirit. Here's our conversation. Hi, Britta. Thank you so much for coming on CJTM.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So you grew up in Stratford, Ontario, a small town known for its theater. Could you talk a little about how you got started in theater and in songwriting? What drew you in?
Totally. So, yeah, both my parents were pit musicians at the festival. My mom was a trumpet player. My dad was a trombone player. So me and my two sisters kind of like grew up in the orchestra pit or around backstage in the theater, often when they couldn't find childcare. So it was always a really normal part of our life. A lot of the grownups we knew made theater. A lot of what my family did together was make music. But it was when I hit high school in grade 10, I think, there was like a one-act play festival that my school did every year. And if you wrote something for it, you could sign your friends out of class. So I did. I wrote my first musical with one of my best friends. And very quickly, I kind of started to feel, you know, more at home in my own life than I ever had before. And I've been really lucky to not have to stop ever since then, actually.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what's so attractive about the art form to you?
The thing I love about musicals is just how collaborative it is and kind of three-dimensional, that always you're in the room with a big team of thinkers and you're working with them directly. Like, as we're putting Life After up on stage, I'm sitting at a table with designers and lighting designers and a music team and an orchestrator, and we're all kind of problem-solving together how to make something the best it can be. I really love that. I love how many departments up there are, and I love that we're all in the same room. That's a really special and unique thing.
Yeah. So I'm sitting you down here today because I really want to talk about Life After, which opens at the Ed Mervish stage tomorrow. Where did this story come from?
So I lost my dad when I was about 13. And it's not like a directly autobiographical story by any means. Like, the family at the on stage really isn't mine, but I started to just write a few songs later in my adolescence. I was going through another loss and just like being at funerals and eating finger sandwiches and not knowing what to do with my hands. Like, I started to write some music that I didn't know would be for a musical, but this show is about kind of coming of age through loss. You kind of exist in the mind of the 16-year-old girl in the immediate aftermath of her father's sudden death. And so those initial songs that I wrote very much out of my own life, kind of from that, a musical grew that, that's about grieving and growing up, about the kind of altered state of grief. And so it started from a very personal place and has grown into something very much outside of me.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, working on something that's so personal to you, did you face any trepidation or inner turmoil when you were writing it?
Yeah, I think there's always a complexity to writing something that comes from something personal, but it's been the gift is that the family portrayed on stage really isn't a lot like mine, and that this loss takes a very different shape than mine. So it very quickly became something outside of me. It can be complicated to like return to those very complex emotional states, but honestly, it's mostly provided me with a lot of healing. Like, every time we work on it, the full cast, we have really open conversations about grief and what it feels like. And grief can be such a lonely thing. It was such a lonely chapter in my life that it's been a kind of beautiful thing that so much community has grown out of it. So certainly lots of complexity, but I find there's complexity in writing anything. Writing's kind of hard.
Yeah, of course. Uh-huh. Where the truth sort of comes out. I love that you're having those conversations with your cast. Mm-hmm. I heard that you, like one of the songs you wrote when you were 16. In promoting the show, you said it's sort of grown up with you. How have you managed to maintain its intimacy?
I think, yeah, my biggest task in developing this show is trying to maintain that initial impulse. There's music in the show that I wrote when I was 16. There's music in the show that I wrote like truly this week. So I'm collaborating with my younger self, but but trying to preserve that initial impulse was that music that came even before I knew I was going to be a writer, before I knew it was going to be a musical, I think is where like the truth of the story lives. I think people seem to respond to this story as if it's telling them the truth. And I think it's because it comes from that very honest place. So as like my craftsmanship has grown, as I've grown up, the question is like, how do I preserve that initial impulse, that pure thing that where it began, and then do what I can as a writer to support that impulse so that that song I wrote when I was 16 remains in the show, hasn't been rewritten. It's the final song of the show, and I've kind of tried to build a show that honors that song, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. The show has been on stage many times before. It premiered first at the Toronto Fringe Festival in 2016. Could you take me back to that moment? What was it like revealing this material to a live audience for the first time?
It was, I mean, I'll never forget our first show at the Fringe. All honestly, because I kind of didn't know what the show was yet. I think I finished writing it like the day before we opened. My sister Annika was playing the lead. One of my best friends, Kevin, was playing viola next to me. It was this cast of five amazing people. We'd been building it together, and we kind of didn't know what it was. And that first time we presented it to a Fringe audience, I mean, I was terrified. I'd certainly never written anything like this before. It's a bit of a unique little intimate show. Mm-hmm. But I'll never forget. It was quite electric in that room. Like, the audience was really with us. The conversations I got to have afterwards, it felt like we'd really hit on something that was resonating with people. And there's really no better feeling than that. I'll remember that day for the rest of my life. It was, I think it's like on the Fringe schedule. Our show was at like 12:50 p.m. But what an afternoon. It was a beautiful day for me. Yeah.
An eventful afternoon.
Exactly.
Definitely. You said you've been having these conversations with your cast about grief, and it's been nearly a decade since that show premiered. Your sister, Annika, as you said, played the lead in that Fringe show. And then we have actresses like Brielle Braid, who has followed you through other productions like Dr. Silver, Celebration of Life. She played Kate at Canadian Stage. How have the artists you've gotten to work with on this helped shape the piece in its final form?
I feel like everyone who's touched it has really shaped this piece. I feel so many amazing artists are kind of woven into its fabric forever. I write so much in the room, learning from the artists I'm working with and trying to make a show that honors their voices. And I'm really lucky to have a very vibrant community of artists that I've grown up with that I continue to collaborate with. Like, even Kaylee Harwood, who played Kate in our Fringe production, is now one of the Furies in this production. So many of the Canadians in the cast are like return collaborators who I've really grown up with. And that feels like a very beautiful, special thing. And also every time I reopen working on this show, I like hear the voices of all the amazing people who've worked on it in the past, who, like, many of whom have remained some of my closest friends. It's been a really it's a gift that keeps on giving with community. And I feel really grateful to everyone who's touched it, because I think the best thing I can do as a writer is be a really active collaborator. Listen to my collaborators, listen to the artists in the room, and learn as much as I can from them. And that's forever kind of woven into this show, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's beautiful that you've been able to connect with so many people through that way and just grown this community. I want to talk to you about poetry. It's a very beautiful song. I want to know where the song came from, when you wrote it, and where its place is sort of in the show. How does it fit?
Yeah, so that was one of the very, very first songs I wrote for this show. It's kind of one of the very first songs I wrote in my life. So that's the one that's really grown up with me. I wrote it. I mean, the easy link is, of course, to the loss of my dad. It's a personal thing. But I actually started to write this after one of my best friends passed away later in high school. And it was in those following weeks where I started to write some of this music. And poetry kind of came from that. I think that when you're grieving, you're in such a altered kind of poetic state. It's hard to capture in words. You're living in the past and present. It's devastating. It's sometimes funny. It's very strange. And I couldn't find the words for it. So I wrote this song called Poetry, which is just about someone who's not finding the words for something. Much of a poet. I don't have the words to describe the state that this young woman is in, but we've made a whole show to try to get to this end. The center of it, which is really what poetry is about. So poetry's kind of been my guiding light as a writer. It's one of the first things written for this show, and it's kind of like about making a show that honors that song, that honors the kind of ethos of that song. And that's the one that very much came from a very lonely and difficult moment in my life, and it's amazing what it's grown into.
Can I ask what made you return to it? Like, what drew you back to the song after so many years?
I don't know. The song's always been in the show. A few years later, I was a playwright in residence for something called the Paprika Festival, which is for young writers here in the city. It's a free program. Everyone who wants to make theater is young in the city should do it. It's an amazing, amazing program. And that's where I started to write this, to really like turn this into a script. And the song had just kind of stayed with me. I played it a lot. I hadn't shown it to that many people. And I just started to write some scenes around it first. And then it became clear that what I wanted to write was a musical. And it was pretty soon after writing it that I figured out that's where it wanted to be. But yeah, it was through Paprika, which I endorse now on this radio station. Everyone who wants, the young writers in the city, you should apply. It's an amazing program.
There you go. Shout out. As someone that's worked with you, I could see how like a song takes shape or all the different forms it takes. And you've been talking about how you'll be tinkering with something up until maybe even a week before the show is set to take a Mervish stage. How do you know when a song's ready to share when it's done? Is there ever closure or a finality to the process?
I mean, I'm a writer who is pretty relentless in my desire to rewrite. And
right.
Sometimes my team has to say, like, you have to like sit down for now. The show's done. Mm-hmm. But I think usually with a song, you kind of feel in your body if it's working or not. Unfortunately, a big part of writing is sharing things that aren't done, that aren't ready. Like, I'll bring in something where I'm like, I know this isn't quite here yet. It hasn't quite arrived at what it wants to be. But if I work with people in the room and we collectively... there's like usually an element of collaboration that gets me there. But I do think I find when writing scenes, it's kind of harder to know if it's working. I have to put it in front of an audience to know if rhythmically it's working, if the laughs are working, if the beats are working. But with music, it's kind of a physical thing. Like when a song is in the pocket, when it's doing, when it's landing where it wants to, usually you can kind of feel that in the room. And I kind of exist in the world mostly as a composer, so I have a lot easier time telling if music is working than if text is working, but we're going in front of our first audience.
I want to go back to just something you said earlier in Stratford. Mm-hmm. You said you sort of put together this full-length musical.
It was called Big Box Story.
Big Box Story.
How
did that, like, how did that happen? Because that was on a Stratford stage, and you were pretty young at that time. Yeah,
I was, I guess, an audacious teen. I don't know. It was in my grade. I'd written some one-act shows for my school, and then in grade 11, I started to write my first full-length. It looked like Walmart was going to come to the city, which was very, I think, scary for our local economy, and I was a young activist, very anti-corporation, and I knew a lot more than I do now, as young people do, but I started to write this show that was kind of, it was like an absurd, very satirical show set in a big box store about corporate greed. And I kind of very bravely asked my principal, like, hey, could I get 2 co-op credits if I write our school's musical? And she said yes, which meant I didn't have to take science class, which was amazing for me.
2 birds, one stone.
And exactly. I was just, efficient. And it was this amazing moment in my life where it had a cast of like 40 of my peers.
Wow.
And it just kept gaining more and more local support. I think locals who were part of that fight against Walmart started to line up behind us.
Mm-hmm.
We ran at our high school, and then we just kept extending and extending and extending. And there were some letters to the editor written by community members that were like, Stratford, you should put this on the stage. And then we ended up, on the Avon stage in this gala presentation, which remains the coolest night of my life so far, for sure. Me and like 40 other teenagers totally getting away with something. But there was something to just like, when you're young and you don't know you can't do something yet, it was like, what if we did this? And then we did. And it's like, I try to hold that version of me in my heart. I was a lot braver then than I am now, but, it was a really cool moment of community support. Like, really, the success of that show was because the community rallied around us. And it remains one of the most beautiful things that's ever happened to me.
I love that. What would you tell that Britta, like, if they could see you kind of now? I know that might be an impossible question to answer, but what would you tell that younger version of yourself?
Honestly, I think I'd probably thank her. Because it was the fact that she started so young and that she did it so bravely with as many of her peers as possible that, like, I kind of owe her my whole my whole life. And I don't know, like, she was braver than I am. I think she was younger and no one had told her no yet. She didn't know she was trying to be a professional writer. There's like certain pressures right. you get in your head as soon as you professionalize that you have to work against. And mm-hmm. the purity of just doing it out of the love of it, out of the love of working with your peers, she did me a big favor that I managed to get it starts before I got as neurotic as I am now. You know, I think she did me a big favor. She was very brave, and I thank her. And I think she would be really excited to know we were about to go up at Mervish. I think she wouldn't believe it, but I like talking about her like she's a different person from me.
Yeah, it's kind of fun. Yeah. There's two versions. It's a past life.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure she'd be very proud of you. It was great to have you on, Britta.
Thank you so much for having me.
Poetry, the song you heard was performed by Isabel Esther in that version, who plays Alice in the Mervish Run, with Lynn Schenkel on orchestrations, arrangements, and music supervision. And of course, the song is written and composed by Britta Johnson. I'm Mia Johnson with the Local Journalism Initiative.
You still have a couple of weeks to catch up with the musical Life After in Toronto.
Abakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
The savagery of war and the courage of Canadian servicemen and women, including that which his own son, Chuck, endured on his tour in Afghanistan, were all the motivation Wayne Krangle needed to start producing maple syrup for charity, and he named it Syrup for Soldiers. His liquid gold comes from more than 200 sugar maples that Wayne has on his property in the Algonquin Highlands. Now in its 16th season, Wayne is in charge of production while his son Chuck, a former corporal and Toronto police officer, handles sales and marketing of Syrup for Soldiers. Proceeds from the sales of this maple syrup go to support the Wounded Warriors Fund. Elizabeth Oakley in Haliburton, Ontario, recently visited the father and son duo on a cold April day to find out why Syrup for Soldiers has been such a sweet success.
Wayne Krangle and his son Chuck share a bond that's thicker than blood. In fact, many would say it's as thick as maple syrup. And it's that bond and a mission to support those who've served in the military that's truly making a difference. Chuck served as a corporal for the Canadian military in Afghanistan, driving an armored ambulance in combat missions. Chuck was one of the lucky ones who made it out alive and uninjured. But sadly, 168 Canadian servicemen and women never made it home over the 20-year war. When he returned from his tour of duty in 2007, Chuck gave his father a copy of 15 Days by the late renowned Toronto columnist Christy Blatchford. The book details the courage of the military men and women as they face dangerous situations with determination and national pride. Wayne was so moved by the book that he was inspired to do something to honor his son and other members of the military. Living on 350 acres in Algonquin Highlands, and fortunate enough to have more than 200 sugar maples on his property, Wayne decided to make his own maple syrup for charity. Chuck then suggested the proceeds could go to Wounded Warriors, an organization devoted to wounded soldiers who face physical and emotional challenges. And the rest, they say, is history. Wayne admits it was a lofty goal that came with a steep learning curve and a lot of trial and error. But now, 16 years later, the liquid gold, aptly called Syrup for Soldiers, is a sweet success.
And after reading the book, I basically was in tears. And the reason I was in tears is I was thinking about all of the carnage that our fellow countrymen suffered while serving our country. And very graphic things, you know, like eyes gone or legs blown off. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is like, what can I do?
As any maple syrup producer will tell you, making it involves a lot of work and a lot of time spent around an evaporator. Dependent on the weather, the season is a short one, lasting on average 4 to 6 weeks. In the forest surrounding Wayne's home and sugar shack, the sugar maples are tapped, and a web-like myriad of tubing brings the sap by gravity to awaiting collection barrels. Once full, the sap is transferred to the outdoor evaporator, then boiled down to become maple syrup. It's a labor of love, though, as Wayne is outside in all kinds of weather, rain, snow, and everything in between, watching over the evaporator for hundreds of hours each year. There's a division of labor, too. Wayne runs production, while Chuck, now a retired Toronto Police Service officer, leads marketing and sales for Syrup for Soldiers. Every year, his former colleagues snap up as many bottles as they can.
But a lot of people realize that, yeah, it's produced in March or whatever, but, you know, for me, we make it, and then I'm usually sold out by June or July, depending on when Wayne bottles it, and my mother. I'll sell out right away, but I'll throughout the year, oh yeah, anybody that sees me, they know I'm the maple syrup guy, so yeah, if I'm at different divisions or whatever, oh hey, Chuck, You got any maple syrup? What's going on with the maple? When's the maple syrup coming? So I usually get that throughout the year.
The father and son duo are passionate about the contribution they're making in support of Canadian servicemen and women. And it's that passion that's led to Wayne recently being honored with the King Charles Coronation Medal. And while the recognition is deeply appreciated, for both Wayne and Chuck, it's not what motivates them. Together, Syrup for Soldiers has raised nearly $100,000 for the Wounded Warriors Fund.
Wayne named it, and, you know, he named it Syrup for Soldiers in the sense that he kind of started it with me in mind, and as well as all the proceeds are going to help the wounded vets. So what a perfect name, Syrup for Soldiers.
You must really love your dad a lot.
Yeah, and I love what he's done. It's very selfless.
Thanks to Elizabeth Oakley.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
And some 250 kilometers away from the Algonquin Highlands, you can find the Hillsburg maple syrup producer, The Tree Farm. Last year, owner Derek Elliott was able to start tapping trees as early as February. He called it the winter that didn't happen, and during which, says Elliott, you could have gone in away with late January if you really wanted to. All thanks to an unusual warm winter. As the new season gets underway, the farm has a brand new event in store this year. Journalist Riley Gillespie Wilson chatted with Elliott.
A variety of syrups and a new event highlight this new season for Elliott Tree Farm. The harvest season, Elliott reports, was a successful one with one main factor: consistency despite different weather patterns.
It was a good season. We've got all grades. We got a golden, amber, and dark. It's interesting, you know. It can come in different formats, but, you know, it's interesting how it came out similar in production.
Elliott says this time of year is one to behold in the industry.
We're here to promote Ontario maple syrup. All of the farms that you see with the buckets hanging out around here, it's a tradition. It's a sign of spring. It's the first harvest of the year in Canada. And, you know, it's something we can all be proud of.
He went on to explain at least 80% of maple syrup is produced in Ontario, home to the Maple Syrup Museum of Ontario. His farm, he says, puts on the Sugarbush Experience this year, a brand new event.
This is where you can book a 10:30, 12:30, or 2:30, have a guided tour back through the sugar bush, learn how maple syrup is produced, learn about different tree species. And we do the maple toffee over ice with a stick. You taste our golden, amber, and dark maple syrup, and then choose which one or all three of those that you want to pour over a waffle.
At the beginning of the season, Elliott explains, syrup produced is golden before darkening throughout the season. This is Riley Gillespie Wilson.
And that's all for us at Viewpoints. A big thank you to our journalists this week, Mia Johnson, Elizabeth Oakley, and Riley Gillespie Wilson. Our national editors are Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Thanks for keeping us company this week, and until the next, ciao.
radio at frequencynews.ca. Radio at frequencynews.ca.